This is the live edition of Mideast Madness for Monday, July 8, 2013. If you're listening at 3:05 p.m. on July the 8th, you can call in to this show. You can talk to me. You can let your voice be heard and turn this show into a truly interactive experience. What a novel idea, huh? A call-in radio show. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, that's 427-3772. And in the spirit of counterculture, communityism, we have an alternative line, number two. Again, area code 831-469-3119. That's line 2-469-3119. This is the Mideast Madness Show, Monday version. I am Ren Tawil. I am the childish brain behind this project. I am also a Palestinian-American born and raised in the SF Bay Area in California. South Bay, mostly. Okay, let's get this out of the way here. Now, whoops. Oh, very good. We have an additional listener. Okay, in terms of the Middle East, it's been an interesting week with the replacement of Muslim Brotherhood elected president Mohamed Morsi with another guy whose name I can't recall at the moment. That news is about a week old, so it's not like it's news of the day. But, you know, I did have my buddy Sami Khaled here a few weeks ago, a native of Egypt, current resident of San Lorenzo Valley. And Sami is just about the friendliest guy you'd ever want to know. I think he's basically very happy. And with some trepidation, he did express an interest in appearing on my show, as he eventually did. And quite frankly, I didn't think the show was terribly earth-shattering in terms of his experience, but the important thing is I had a guest on the show. And Sami is from Egypt. Maybe some of the many, many thousands of you out there who heard the show, who may remember his performance, the interview, might be willing to talk about Egypt or any place else in the Middle East. Obviously, with my being who and what I am, a Palestinian American, my interest is talking about Arabs and Israelis, and Palestinians and Israelis. But until we do that, I want to talk about Rush Limbaugh. Yes, you heard me right. You see, there is something called the Daily KOS, K-O-S. And I keep forgetting what that stands for or what KOS means. But they did forwarded to me a message entitled, "Rush Limbaugh admits Stop Rush is kicking his ass." Rush Limbaugh admits that it's Stop Rush is kicking his ass. This is actually dated originally April 24th. On Tuesday's show, Rush Limbaugh acknowledged that the sniveling jerks of the Stop Rush movement has driven his advertising possibilities into the ground. Here is a couple of short paragraphs. Quoted from Rush, when you look at a show that is by far number one, and they're still running penile enhancement ads, what's happening is that mainstream media buyers are sending money elsewhere, trying to harm them. Well, penile, take your pick. The Ronco Vegematic, you know, while McDonald's and Coke and Meineke are everywhere else. These are things we had to overcome on this pro. We have to fight that battle every day here anyway. Because these little sniveling jerks are out there trying to scare advertisers. Still goes on. End quote. As usual, Rush Limbaugh has some of his facts confused. The little sniveling jerks he refers to would be the Stop Rush movement, groups like the Flush Rush Facebook community. But these groups aren't, quote, trying to scare advertisers, end quote. They're simply contacting advertisers and quoting Rush Limbaugh verbatim to be sure the sponsor is aware of what they're being associated with. Many of them aren't aware, and they often choose to pull their ads off the show. 2,638 have requested their ads not air on the Rush Limbaugh Show as of today. Let me give you that figure again. This is not petitioners or individual members or voices. This is the number of advertisers. 2,638 have requested their ads not air on the Rush Limbaugh Show as of today. I take it to mean that 2,638 is the number of ads, advertisers, who had at one time or another already been advertising on Rush's show. Dispatch continues here, but the reason these organizations pull their ads off the show isn't because of Stop Rush volunteers, it's because of the offensive content that comes out of Limbaugh's mouth, including regular homophobic rants, racial stereotypes, poor bashing, as in the poor of the world, and even last week's incredibly insensitive jokes about exploding pressure cookers, just one day after three people were brutally murdered in Boston. Again, this is this particular dispatch dates back to April 24th, 3 months ago. Respectable organizations want nothing to do with that kind of thing. In bolden type, it says here, Limbaugh alone is responsible for his advertiser exodus, nobody else. As Limbaugh's large, well-known advertisers have headed for the door, ad rates that Limbaugh used to call, quote, confiscatory ad rates have dropped to all-time lows. Advertisers like Sony, Hallmark, Cadillac, and Office Depot have been replaced by a ragtag bunch including a suspected pyramid scheme, shady identity protection software, and even a church led by a murdering pastor. Oh, and the penile enhancements. One of Limbaugh's faithful advertisers is the National Mail Medical Clinic, one of quite a few similar businesses peddling cures to men with limp noodles. Just wetting my whistle here. Continuing. Limp noodles sagging into wet whistles. Is that a contradiction in terms or what? Continuing, a warning to anyone who clicks on the YouTube link in the second tweet on this particular email, folks. It's a graphic video of, quote, Mr. S. injecting erectile dysfunction medication directly into his penis because that's how far L. Rushbo has sunk. Now he's plugging intrapenous drug use. Actually, advertising woes aside, Limbaugh is the perfect spokesman for erectile dysfunction. He was once detained after a Dominican Vatican... I'm sorry, he was once detained after a Dominican vacation, that would be the Dominican Republic, with an illegal Viagra prescription. So, Limbaugh's advertising rates continue to plummet, and Stop Rush continues to monitor the Rush Limbaugh show across the country and quote Limbaugh to his advertisers. And all the while, Rush keeps digging that hole deeper and deeper. Find out how you can help hold Rush Limbaugh accountable after the curly fry. Decent folks who believe in tolerance and equality are no longer powerless against Limbaugh's efforts to spread intolerance on the radio. Stop Rush is making a major impact by convincing advertisers on this show to withdraw their ads. And with your help, we can do even more. Just a few emails, tweets, or Facebook messages a week to Limbaugh's advertisers can go a long way toward making hatred less profitable. It is our collective voice that makes us strong. And, of course, apparently there is a plethora of details about the various charges and descriptions that I've read to you, but they're all in the form of links, computer links, that I suppose I could click on them, but it would just make this was supposed to be a short reading here that much longer. If you're interested in the Stop Rush movement, first of all, they say, want to do something to hold Limbaugh accountable? Join Stop Rush. We can use your help in the following ways. Join the Flush Rush Facebook community. You know, many years ago, there was a print newsletter, I believe, called the Flush Rush Review or Flush Rush something. And it kind of petered out for whatever reason. It was very peculiar because I tried going to Flush Rush many months ago a couple of times on the World Wide Web. And it appeared as though either Limbaugh himself or people who are in support of Rush Limbaugh had taken over that website. But now there is the Flush Rush Facebook community. They also want you to visit the Stop Rush sponsor database. Tweet to Stop Rush Twitter campaign. You know, the pound sign first and then Stop Rush. Fact check the Limbaugh lie debunking site and install Think Context Stop Rush browser extension. Notifies you as you browse which companies advertise on Rush. And this was originally posted to Prolegs on Wednesday, April 24, 2013. At 1:53 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Also republished by Sluts. Sluts. Tell you what, I will check out Sluts. And it appears that it is... Oh, come on. Go away. The link went directly to another Daily Kos website here. It's just the header on this site, whatever it is. So go to Sluts, as it were, right? You know what I'm talking about. Okay, I am a very long-time hater of Rush Limbaugh. personally, so I've been looking for an excuse to read this piece that I received from Daily Kos. And so there. In terms of how this may possibly connect with anything having to do with Israel and Palestinians, or Israelis and Palestine, he has very rarely, you know, I do listen when I have the stomach for it, to monitor him. And he knows, Rush knows that we're monitoring him. He's been doing this for so long. He has some reasonably intelligent idea of what's going on amongst those who take derision with him. Wetting my whistle a little more. But once in a great, great while, he will say something about the Middle East. And the ones that I happen to catch, the last two or three times that I heard him make any reference to Palestinians was in bashing Hamas, which is the governmental body ruling in the Gaza Strip. Not my favorite bunch to party with. In fact, they are, in essence, the same Muslim Brotherhood which controlled Egypt for about a year recently, up until about a week ago. But Hamas was elected, duly elected, in fair elections as they were monitored by the world community. Jimmy Carter was there okaying the process, the voting processes, duly elected by the people of Gaza, who are Palestinians. And he, you know, Limbaugh uses the word terrorist far more than Hamas or the leaders or Palestinians. He was verbally ransacking the terrorists of Gaza for their nasty habit of occasionally firing rockets and mortars into Israel from Gazan territory. Which is, by the way, still considered by the United Nations, according to its own conventions and definitions, to be occupied territory. Even though Israel is no longer physically occupying the Gaza Strip in the form of militant Israeli Jewish settlements, the Israeli army, the IDF, is, of course, covering all the border crossings except those going into Egypt, of course, in the south. But they have had a long-standing agreement with Egypt, with whom Israel is technically at peace, although often a very cold peace. And these army guys still go into and actually shoot into Gazan space. They shoot at people and sometimes hit them and kill them. All kinds of interesting stories that you never find on mainstream media in the good old U.S. of A. The Israeli army does occasionally venture into or patrol, whatever they want to call it, Gaza itself. They cross the border. And they highly restrict those who can go in and leave the Gaza Strip. Very often, if any non-Jewish native of the Gaza Strip leaves, Israel forbids them from coming back in. So anyway, the point is Gaza is still technically under occupation, as is the West Bank, clearly under military occupation by Israel. But you got Rush Limbaugh, who's screaming about the terrorists, and did so in the most vile, aggressive, angry voice that he could muster, taking about 30 seconds to refer to them as the enemies of Israel, therefore they're the enemies of peace-loving Americans, blah, blah, blah. So, once again, not that there's a big connection between the Middle East and the middle of Rush Limbaugh, but there you have it. Again, consider joining the Flush Rush Facebook community, or at least going to the Flush Rush base, Facebook community. Or visit the Stop Rush sponsor database. Just Google Stop Rush or Stop Rush sponsor. Tweet pound Stop Rush Twitter campaign. Fact check at the Limbaugh Lie debunking site. Limbaugh Lie debunking site. That should be really interesting. Mother Jones, many, many years ago, did an article on that subject alone, on his lies. And they even have their Think Context Stop Rush browser extension. Notifies you as you browse which companies advertise on Rush. Very, very active. Kind of a BDS movement within itself. Boycott, divestiture, and sanction against Israel is well known. And no longer just within the counter community of progressives. It's getting a lot more lip service or more attention paid to it by the rest of Americans too, who generally don't give a crap. Okay, Rush Limbaugh. It's 2:27 p.m. This is the Mideast Madness Show. My name is Ren. Streaming live at the moment on July the 8th, 3:27 p.m. Here's another short piece that I... This is not really necessarily the stuff of this show, Mideast Madness, but it is a review, more or less. And it's actually dated July 9, today's July 8th of 2013. This review is dated July 9, 2010. So it was a good 3 years and one day ago when this first came out. Review of the book Hebrew Myths by Robert Graves. Robert Graves is the author of Hebrew Myths, and this review is by Steve Ithuza Granwich, who is a teacher with Los Angeles Unified School District. That's all I know about him. Steve says, if you want a deeper understanding of the first 61 stories in Genesis, then this book is a great place to start. With the help of eminent scholar Raphael Patai, Mr. Graves analyzes Hebrew mythology, the first stories about the flood, the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, etc., are examined against the backdrop of Sumerian mythology. All those elements were in Sumeria prior to their inclusion into the Hebrew Bible. The flood in Sumeria was caused by man being too loud. It was Enki, E-N-K-I, who communicated to Utanfishtim to build the ark. This is according to the Sumerian legend now. Enlil was good with it afterwards. Ea, E-A, also tells Adapa, the first man, that when visiting the gods, he must not eat any of their food for fear it may be poisoned. It turns out that he wanted to give Adapa the food of immortality. God's creation myth had several parallels in common with Egyptian and Sumerian mythology. In all three mythologies, there is a separation of firmaments. Lilith is Sumerian mythology. In Sumerian mythology, is part of a race of demons that seduces people at night and then drinks their blood. These demons are called Lilin. Lilith, Lilin. In Midrashic mythology, Lilith is one who does not submit to Adam's authority. She ends up cavorting with the demon. Throughout the book, Robert Graves' book, Hebrew Myths, Hebrew mythology is measured up against many other mythologies. Oftentimes, parallels are found and differences explained. Oftentimes, it is very evident that cultures borrowed extensively from each other. Sometimes myths traveled from Canaan, the old name for Palestine or for Israel, from Canaan to Greece, and sometimes it was the other way around. Where was I? Okay. Going back through time, it seems that there have been Canaanite settlements in Greece and there have been Greek settlements in Canaan. Myths travel along with people. The sojourn in Egypt is analyzed with the backdrop in history. There was a general in Egypt who was sold by his parents for corn. He helped Egypt defeat troops and was in charge of granaries. In fact, many people in Canaan have been promoted to high position. In all, Robert Graves does a great job of explaining the Bible in its cultural context. Of course, his material may be dated, as much new material has been unearthed thanks to archaeological excavations. Okay, that is the review of the book. I have not seen the book, and I'm not sure if I had heard of this particular book. It seems to me over the past 3 years, it's crossed an ear or two of mine. I got to tell you, though, the way this guy writes, this Steve Ithuza Granwich, of course, you can't see it on radio or even on your, while listening to us on streaming live online, but he's got a picture ostensibly of himself, looks like Jesus Christ, which is to say the picture of him looks like the popular rendition of Jesus Christ's looks. But he writes real funny. I mean, he just, for somebody, according to his Facebook page, he's with Los Angeles Unified School District. I think it said he was a teacher or on the faculty staff. For all I know, he's the janitor there. But he doesn't seem to write well. assuming that's any authoritative measure of one's intelligence, I'm simply expressing my hesitation of the validity of where this guy is coming from mentally. This review got a number of reviews or comments from people who tuned into it via the internet. Yisrael Ben Tzvi Hirsch said, "Not a bad review." That's what he said. Let me give you some hints. First off, when you write reviews, first decide if this is a review or a summary. Your book reviews are a cross between. If you write summaries, take notes of what you read. It will make your summaries more clear and concise, as well as more balanced. Your summaries tend to emphasize the beginning of a book and fade out at the end. Also, don't go overboard on the details. Give summaries of the chapters and a few detail. This guy leaves out letters and words, too. Your reviews get too long and people do not read them. July 9, 2010. Same day as the dispatch, as the review itself. Well, I started off saying that the subject of this book review here, end of the book, is not exactly the stuff of what I usually talk about on Mideast Madness, but it touches a nerve with me because so much of what people use as the proper justification for the existence of a national Jewish state, for the existence of Israel, and as a justification for Zionism, is based on what their Bible tells them, and what the Old Testament of the Christian Bible tells the Christians. But I have come across many indications, many very enlightening analyses of these so-called justifications for Zionism, and there's a lot of myth involved. So this is the latest one I've come across, a book which apparently came out 3 years ago or more, entitled Hebrew Myths, written by Robert Graves. If you are listening to me and you love Israel anyway, or you are an Israeli, my guess is your immediate inclination is to dismiss the author, Mr. Graves, as an anti-Semite and not even pay any attention to it. And you're going to say, why bother? He hates Jews. That's his real motivation. That's the conclusion you would be jumping to if you're Israeli and listening to this show. I won't read it. And I've personally had experiences with people who just won't go there. If they don't want to get into a debate or get new information for me or share information with me on a two-way street, people have shut me out, sometimes angrily. I see it as a kind of stranglehold, emotional stranglehold on American opinion on the part of those who support Israel. Just never mind the facts, just go with it. Israel exists now. We're no longer talking about giving the land back to the Palestinians. They'll tell you they're not real Palestinians anyway. We won't give it back to the Arabs or the Palestinians, whatever you want to call them. Israel is here to stay. It doesn't make any difference how we're treating the Palestinians, but of course, in fact, it does, since the Palestinians are still very much alive and not being treated well. The great majority of them denied genuine political rights. They don't have a lot of pull within the Palestinian Authority, which manages the occupation in the West Bank for Israel. That's really what the PA does, as I see it. They have no political rights according to Israeli law. They're governed by military law. And even though Israeli Palestinians are permitted to vote to a limited extent, by the way, those who support Israel love to brag about how the Arabs have all the same political rights as the Israelis. Well, they do not have all the same rights as Israelis, politically or otherwise. They're depending on where you live within Jerusalem, as I spoke about on my Saturday morning show, whether you live inside the city of Jerusalem or its former suburbs, which have now been incorporated into the city of Jerusalem, whether you've been there for any degree of time or not, you may or may not be able to vote in local elections, and none of them, no Jerusalemite Palestinians are permitted to vote in Knesset elections. So much for Israel's magnanimous and liberal and oh-so-generous election laws governing Arabs, governing non-Jews within Israel. But getting back to those, to the ones living under occupation, no political rights at all to speak of, no civil rights, and very little in the way of human rights vis-a-vis how Israel governs them and controls them. So if you're going to justify to any degree, through any avenue, the existence of the State of Israel and the promise, the 125-odd-year-old promise of Zionism, which is just not working out early now in the 21st century, be very careful about where you're coming from. Be very careful and become more knowledgeable about the underpinnings that are connected with your ancient Hebrew ancestors and fish out the myths, because there are myths, many, many of them, which perhaps unwittingly are used to support the idea of an Israel. Okay. We have spoken about Rush Limbaugh, Robert Graves' book, Hebrew Myths. Here's another kind of PSA, which comes to us by way of Jewish Voice for Peace. Jewish Voice for Peace is a wise, sincere effort to get the truth out about what's really happening with Palestinians and Israelis and the way they treat each other. Announcement from JVP. South Bay Jewish Voice for Peace invites you to join us at the San Jose Peace and Justice Center at 7 p.m. this Friday, July 12th. Again, at the San Jose Peace and Justice Center, 7 p.m. Friday, July 12th of this week, for a talk by Maxine Kaufman-Lacosta, author of the book, Refusing to be Enemies, Palestinian and Israeli Nonviolent Resistance to the Israeli Occupation. Maxine Kaufman-Lacosta lived in Jerusalem for 7 years and has written widely on Palestinian and Israeli nonviolent activism. San Jose Peace and Justice Center is located at 48 South 7th Street in San Jose and is accessible via bus routes, etc., etc., mini bus routes, including the Highway 17 Express, which connects Santa Cruz, Scotts Valley, and San Jose, and San Jose's light rail transit system gets you there too. Again, the address is San Jose Peace and Justice Center, 48 South 7th Street in San Jose. The talk begins at 7 p.m. Suggested donation, $5 to $10, though no one will be refused for lack of funds. When people say no one will be refused for lack of funds, it is because they appreciate the educational value of the event, which opens it up to more of the community and makes it more than just an opportunity to raise funds for itself. Refusing to be Enemies will be available. The book, Refusing to be Enemies, will be available for purchase and signings. See you there. For information on this meeting or other South Bay events, email us at southbay@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. For news and analysis on Israel and Palestine, current JVP campaigns, and the JVP National Meeting, visit jewishvoiceforpeace.org. That's the www dot version of jewishvoiceforpeace.org. Yeah. Apparently this was an addendum to an earlier message that I got. Same message, essentially. Okay, maybe I'll read that to you again before the end of this show. We have about another hour and a quarter to go. It's 3:44 p.m. PDT here on the west coast of North America. Okay, now we shall take a musical interlude. In case you've already fallen asleep, I'll make your dreams a little sweeter. And then when I come back, I'll wake you up. And by the way, you are listening to Azza. Currently being drowned out by the sound of my voice. Azza is a local band of musicians and singers. Local as in Santa Cruz, California. Azza, A-Z-A. This is a 10-year-old album that I just got a hold of. I went to a performance entitled Mosaic, an artistic bent on the situation in Palestine and Israel. It's called something like that. And the piece you were just listening to was called Agarid. Seems like the really important stuff is written in Arabic here. And I no longer read Arabic with any fluency to speak of. Azza, A-Z-A. Okay, let me give you something else quickly before we get to the meat of this next item here. As I was talking about last Saturday, and the Mideast Madness show has expanded to an additional time slot every Saturday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. We had our third show 2 days ago. And towards the end of the show, I was talking about my personal concern and how it ties in with my desire for this show to grow and thrive and not just preach to the choir. I really want to get it out to the community. And one of the things that spurs me on in this desire is fear. The primary motivator for all motion among living animals on Earth, fear. Because I know they're listening to me. I've known about the NSA, the National Security Agency's monitoring activities for many, many years. People jumping on the bandwagon when it hit the mainstream news here a month or two ago, so many of them were acting like, oh my goodness, this can't be. I mean, this is America. There was plenty of denial going around, I take it for granted. And even when people allowed it to settle in and percolate, many of them acted like it was a big surprise, that they had no idea. But the most recent news reports made this major outcropping of uncovery of what the NSA is doing and other agencies as well had to do with the specific action of them doing a very filtered monitoring of looking for certain words and phrases and identities within the emails and phone calls and perhaps other communications. The fact that they do it in a filtered manner, NSA and the White House's defense is that we don't exactly read individual emails or listen to individual calls. It's all the listening is done by computer, on computer. And we're looking for elements that help us to defend you from the big bad terrorists. And the NSA denies, while they're denying that they go into the meat of the contents of these conversations, it's still pretty obvious that there's no denying that they can, if they want to, read and listen to whatever they want to, whenever they want to. So, what does that have to do with my personal PSA? I take it for granted that this show is being filtered and run through the pewter as well with everything else, that my personal as well as MideastMadness@gmx.com emails are being sent through the sieve, through the filter there as well. And not that I think anyone in the government or Black Ops or whoever out there is listening pays serious attention to me. At best, or at worst, depending on the way you look at it, at most, I'm probably considered a laughable nuisance, if anyone would even bother to whisper my name as the person behind this activity here, this radio activity. But they're out there, and I do talk about things, a lot of things that you won't get in the mainstream media and even other free radio or alternative broadcasting outlets or alternative print outlets. I myself often question the sources of the material that I get, and I try to let you in on that when that happens. But on top of the fact that I'm doing this show, I was a founding participant in the Free Gaza movement in the summer of 2008, some 5 years ago. We're coming up on the fifth anniversary of the first voyages of the Free Gaza movement, pretty much founded here. Well, founded to a large extent by people in California, Northern California here, and in a coalition with others in Great Britain and Palestine and other places. The Free Gaza movement began with the two former Greek fishing boats. Hardly state-of-the-art, but I remember co-editor of the book Freedom Sailors, the story of the Free Gaza movement, commenting about how beautiful these boats were to them when they first saw them. You put so much effort, you spend a couple of years into putting the effort and collecting the monies needed to acquire the fishing boats, and they are like, they appear to be as yachts or ocean liners to you when you realize your dreams are starting to be fulfilled. At any rate, the Free Gaza movement succeeded in sending roughly a half dozen missions into the Gaza Strip, into the port of Gaza City. I participated in the first such voyages. Wasn't always fun. It was very hot there and in Cyprus. But considering what so many people in the world go through, I have no right to complain. And then Operation Cast Lead was perpetrated against the people of the Gaza Strip. Took the form of a massacre of about 1,000 people, including some 300 children, as I recall, somewhere between 300 and 500 children. And after Operation Cast Lead, the first of two recent wars against Gaza and Palestinians, the Israeli Navy no longer permitted the Free Gaza movement access to Gaza and kept stopping us most of the time, if not always, when the boats were still in international waters, which amounts to piracy. It is the very definition of piracy to attack someone in international waters, regardless of where they are going or they say they are going or what their plans are. So what if they are a national navy? They're still acting like pirates. They're being pirates. There were, as I'm telling you, several more attempts to sail in. It was eventually, before too long, it was realized that we were not going to have any better luck sending only one or two or three boats in at a time. We needed to send in a flotilla. So all the effort and all the monetary assistance was put forward to build a flotilla of a dozen ships or more. And there were several attempts at doing that. And in a very sad way, before too long, this effort was culminated on May 31st, 2010, in the shooting deaths, the murders of nine activists on board one of these boats, the Mavi Marmara, which was Turkey's contribution to the Freedom Flotilla. The Israelis tried to get away with convincing the world that they were attacked first by these crazed activists, one of whom, by the way, was Turkish-American, American citizen who was shot by the Israeli commandos, by crazed activists who attacked them with their knives and sticks, supposedly. And they even included a video of one of their commandos being jumped on, pushed over the side, and it was the video was very unrevealing to me. You couldn't tell who was who anyway. It came out in subsequent inquiries, judicial inquiries, that, number one, the Israeli commandos acted with extremely undue enthusiasm in their assault on the boat, and that it was indeed the Israeli commandos who boarded the boat. And then they tried to say what their killing of the activists was okay because the people on the boat were trying to defend themselves. It came out, as I said, that it was the commandos Navy commandos who boarded the boat, and those who were shot and killed by the Israelis, who were wearing armored vests and helmets, and who, of course, were bearing automatic rifles, just to call them submachine guns, shot these people, in some cases, in the head and in the back. So how can you shoot someone in the back in self-defense? Israel's own military courts made this determination. There were at least two, well, there was one or two major whitewash attempts to clear the Israeli naval commandos and therefore clear Israel of any wrongdoing. When you look at the details of the Palmer Uribe report and the other one, I can't recall what it's called now, you'll see that it was not a balanced report, that it was purely agenda-driven, trying to blame everything on the activists who simply wanted to enter the port of Gaza in solidarity with the Palestinians and to bring them much needed construction, medical, and other materials. So, here I'm spending between 5 and 10 minutes going, as I have many times on the show, into the details of what the Free Gaza Movement is about and the fact that I'm associated with them. I, along with other members of the First Endeavor 2008, freely, of our own accord, submitted our names to somebody, I don't remember who specifically, as participants in that event, and that if they wanted to take some kind of legal action against me, well, go ahead. Because I'm in solidarity with the Palestinians, I am in solidarity with the Free Gaza Movement, a kind of founding member yet. And we were hearing some nasty things coming out of politicians' mouth, including one down in Southern California who declared that everyone associated with the Free Gaza Movement, both sailing crew and support back on Cyprus or wherever around the world, should be executed. He went so far as to say they should be killed because we, as his way of looking at it, were nothing more than supporters of Hamas terrorism. That's how ugly it got. And maybe they still feel that way. The point is, because of my fairly recent history of doing that and my continuing with this cause by starting up and hosting Mideast Madness on the radio, on the internet, somebody's watching me. It's a kind of, well, call it paranoia, if you will, but it's the kind of paranoia that may just preserve my life a little longer. I'm not exactly a spring chicken anyway, but the point, I really want some people to listen to this radio show, internet or otherwise, internet radio service, and I want them to become interactive with it. I want them to call me. I want to have discussions. Hopefully it won't become a very heated argument, as it has once or twice, because I do endeavor to remain respectful and civil when I talk with people on the phone or when I talk at you over the airwaves. And not just your participation in that form directly, but in getting the word out. I don't want to just preach to the choir. Let's get some more people interested in Mideast Madness, the show that is, quote unquote. Get the word out, listen, call in, and at the very, very least, at least send a one-way message to MideastMadness@gmx.com. Mideast Madness, all one word, all lowercase, G's in gargantuan, M as in Machiavellian, and X as in Richard X Slattery. .com. Okay, that was the 15-minute long, quarter of an hour, very short PSA about myself and the show that I wanted to get out. Now, let us talk about, or let me talk about, and you listen, if not call in. Just got this today. A friend of mine essentially, he sent me a piece which is from the Times of Israel, internet news service, the Times of Israel, which I believe is still fundamentally Zionist and, of course, is pro-Israel, but once in a while the truth ekes out of their reports. So, on a relative basis, this is fairly balanced news reporting. It says, Israel Action Network takes its cue from U.S. Special Forces, from the war in Iraq to the battle against Israel boycotters. Times of Israel. In a very slight paraphrasing, the guy who sent this to me writes in prefaces, one group is taking an approach used by United States Special Forces and applying it in its struggle against the criticism of Israel. Whereas the subtitle of the Times of Israel report says, one group is taking an approach used by U.S. Special Forces and applying it in its struggle against the BDS movement in America. Or, it's the same thing, struggle against criticism of Israel. I don't like it either when they use a word like struggle, as though they are oppressed people who are defending themselves. That's hardly the case. Okay, here we go. Let me open it. The writing is so tiny in its... Oh, shoot, this is no better. Okay, here we go. If I can get this thing to cooperate again. Written by Lazar Berman, July 7. Yesterday. Can an idea honed on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan prove effective in defending against assaults on Israel's legitimacy in North America? David Dobchek, Deputy Managing Director of the Israel Action Network, thinks so. The idea, in the words of General Stanley McChrystal, commander of the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command, yes, this is the shadowy... non-existent command by the U.S. Under the U.S. and NATO, which was spoken about in the recently released movie Dirty Wars. Commander of the U.S. JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, that, quote, it takes a network to defeat a network, played a central role in his concept for fighting insurgents in the Middle East. It was late 2003, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq was running an extremely effective campaign against American troops and their allies. McChrystal met with his team in a small base near Baghdad, determined to understand the enemy. He quickly realized they were battling an adversary that did not adhere to the traditional military structure, but formed a decentralized network made up of nimble, independent nodes. It became clear to me and to many others that to defeat a networked enemy, we had to become a network ourselves, General McChrystal recalled in Foreign Policy magazine. We had to figure out a way to retain our levels of knowledge, speed, precision, and unity of effort that only a network could provide. IAN, the Israel Action Network, came to the same conclusion. We realized we were facing a different type of challenge, reflected David Dobzhek of IAN. We faced a decentralized challenge originating from different groups. If this is a network challenge, he said, echoing McChrystal, it takes a network to defeat. Anti-Israel activists in the United States create local autonomous groups that communicate and cooperate with a variety of like-minded organizations. But the Jewish community has a network no less impressive. The Jewish Federations of North America, federations, plural, of North America consists of 157 local federations, and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs boasts 125 local community relations councils. Add to those figures Campus Hillels and the religious organizations from the four major streams of Judaism, and the potential of that network starts to become clear. But who would harness the potential synergy of the Jewish communities across the country? IAN, a two-year-old strategic initiative of the Jewish umbrella organizations, seeks to leverage that network of semi-autonomous alliances at the local level to craft appropriate responses to anti-Israel initiatives and to share lessons across the country. It might sound kind of strange for these words to be coming from this radio show, Mideast Madness, but again, I am reading from an article which was released today from the timesofisrael.com. Israel Action Network takes its cue from U.S. Special Forces. So it's kind of like, spy versus spy espionage, as though I had been a mole, and I am passing this along to you under the table, as it were, and so I have to whisper like this. Kind of, it's intrigue, folks. It's fun. It's a rush. Where was I? Planning. Okay, and to share lessons across the country. Every community faces unique issues, said Dabchek, and the message has to be tailored accordingly. IAN staffers, again, IAN is the Israel Action Network, travel to Jewish communities around the country, offering training on strategic planning, messaging, and advocacy. They have provided guidance to over 50 communities on how to effectively respond to boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns, editorials, billboards, and conferences. The message is adapted to each community's specific challenges and demographics in a number of ways, Dabscheck explained. We ask, what's the message? America is broadly pro-Israel, but there are certain constituencies that are susceptible to anti-Israel messages. College campuses, mainline Protestant churches, labor unions, minority groups, the LGBTQ community. Communities need to tailor their messages to each one. They also put emphasis on who delivers the message. We look for people with credibility within that community. For example, labor leaders, speaking to labor leaders. IAN urges local groups to invest in relationships with other constituencies. By doing so, they try to build a firewall against anti-Israel campaigns, broadening the local mainstream pro-Israel consensus and marginalizing the hostile extreme that they say tries to co-opt well-intentioned people. The strategy of building relationships proactively proved timely for the Jewish community in Portland, Oregon. They are one of four pilot communities for the, quote, Community Impact Partnership program, in which the IAN initiates a series of visits to the community to train advocates in building partnerships with local key constituencies. We train people to visit mainline Protestant churches and give the mainstream Jewish view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, explained Bob Horenstein, the Portland Federation's Community Relations and Allocations Director. In April, the local BDS chapter published a letter charging that the Federation's Food for Thought program, which raised money for local food banks during Israel Independence Day celebrations, was inappropriate given Israel's alleged responsibility for food shortages in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The letter was fairly standard, but what concerned Horenstein were the signatures of several local mainline Protestant clergymen on the letter. The IAN-trained community members are now reaching out to their contacts within those churches to explain why they see the BDS movement as harmful to the vision of a peaceful solution to the conflict. Taking advantage of the Jewish community network, when they see what works in one community, IAN is able to share those lessons with their counterparts across the country, who then craft it for their specific challenges. IAN played the unique role of being able to reflect the national and international landscape of the delegitimization movement, said Hindi Popko, Director of Israel and International Affairs at the Jewish Community Relations Council in New York, who has worked with IAN to fight a number of BDS initiatives. They are also able to alert us to things not yet on our radar, she said. Hang on a second here. I'm just looking at something. Oh, very good. We're getting through it. Alert us to things not yet on our radar. The initiative has managed to bring together organizations from both the political right and the left. Right. While the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA met in Pittsburgh to discuss a boycott proposal, J Street's Jeremy Ben-Ami wrote in the Huffington Post that, quote, the one-sided extreme rhetoric that accompanies the global BDS movement makes a mutually agreeable solution more difficult to achieve, not less. Individuals involved with APAC, that's the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and Hasbara Fellowships sit on the same local committees to fight BDS. We are not debating Israeli government policy here, Dabscheck said. The network has achieved some signal successes in its short existence. In 2009, BDS activists began a campaign to get the Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn to stop buying Israeli goods. They tried to position themselves as anti-occupation instead of anti-Israel in an attempt to win over well-meaning members who were not deeply invested in the issue. In 2012, IAN partnered with the JCRC New York to enlist local clergy, create an ad campaign positioning the anti-BDS side as the supporters of a two-state solution, and assemble a panel discussion of progressive organizations opposed to BDS. It resulted in a resounding win, with 60% voting the BDS measure down. They were helpful in sharing appropriate and effective messaging that had worked in the past, and we were able to tailor their tested messages to our local context, recalled Popko. IAN has also managed to mobilize partner organizations to help defeat divestment resolutions in the United Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church USA. In their 2012 conferences, small dedicated groups of activists pushed resolutions calling divestment from corporations operating in Israel, including resolutions calling for divestment from corporations operating in Israel, including Motorola, Caterpillar, and Hewlett Packard. 1,300 rabbis from across the religious spectrum signed a statement opposing BDS called Letter in Hope that was sent to conference delegates. The idea, said Dabscheck, was to show that the Jewish community across the country, including the local leaders that the Christian delegates engage with regularly, oppose BDS efforts and see it as an impediment to interfaith cooperation. Though the effort paid off in 2012, he expects a renewed BDS push in 2014. Church conventions, especially in Canada. The LGBTQ community is a reminder to everyone. LGBTQ. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer, I believe, community has been a lead target for efforts that seek to paint Israel as using its gay rights record to hide its human rights abuses, known as pinkwashing. IAN has worked extensively with A Wider Bridge, an organization dedicated to connecting the Israeli and American LGBTQ communities. A Wider Bridge tried bringing Israeli LGBTQ leaders to Seattle to meet with the local gay community, but BDS activists convinced groups not to sit with the Israelis. IAN worked with the Seattle Jewish Federation to reach out to those groups and secure their agreement to sit with the Israeli delegation. Still, not every effort is an outright success. In April, the University of California, Berkeley Student Senate voted 11-9 to pass a divestment bill. Whenever BDS ends up in the newspaper, it's not a win for us, Popko pointed out. Boy, do I have comments about this whole piece when we're done here, almost done here. Three more short paragraphs. Facing an adversary whose tactics and targets are always changing, Dabscheck tries to anticipate the next battleground. He foresees a rash of resolutions being brought before student governments, especially in the UCAL system. BDS proponents will also shift the scope of their campaigns. From broad approaches like a general boycott, said Dabscheck, they have been trying to narrow their focus on specific companies. He expects anti-Israel activists to co-opt the language of socially responsible investment aimed at corporations. They will challenge companies on their alleged connection to Israeli Defense Forces, IDF actions, asking them to look at other factors beyond profit. This is a new type of advocacy, Dobzhenko emphasized. Real advocacy is not us speaking to ourselves. It is going outside ourselves and sensitizing ourselves to what is effective. End of article. Okay, very, very first thing, I really want to thank those of you who continue to listen to my show and to my sometimes very long, drawn out articles and other various readings. Some of this stuff, perhaps you even hear it in my voice occasionally, in my tone, my inflection. I feel like I'm reading, sometimes it's like I'm reading from a phone book or some kind of corporate list of organizations and committees. Seems like half the time I'm identifying people by their associations. And, of course, always quoting. But thanks again for sticking with and hanging in there and helping make Mideast Madness a forum where people can talk about these things, at least potentially. So no one has called in yet. Let me give you the phone numbers. Area code 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. Line 2, 469-3119. Let's talk, folks. Don't worry about interrupting me. Let me go ahead and get into my direct comments about this. Now, the Times of Israel here comes out headlining this as learning lessons from NATO/US's battles against the bad guys in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and likening the frustrations U.S. troops had, coalition troops had, with the hard-to-pin-down network character of the enemy's tactics. Yeah, as I said earlier, that I'm kind of dubious about the degree of balanced approach that the Times of Israel takes with their articles. To me, this is not so much a balanced report as it is a very complete analysis of this new tactic, and doesn't really discuss the merits of it at all. It's just a report about the nature of the beast, which some would say is good balanced journalism in itself, but I just don't sense a lot of balance in it. It sounds like Times of Israel buys right into this whole operation. Okay. So they start off by analogizing the struggle against BDS, against boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, analogizing it with battlefield troop movements and tactics, being inspired by this quotation from JSOC Commander General Stanley McChrystal: "If it takes a network to defeat it takes a network to defeat a network." So right there, starting the article thusly, by my reading, they're analogizing BDS people all blankedly as anti-Israel, and they use this term over and over again, anti-Israel, anti-Israeli. I'm surprised, and in fact, I'm kind of impressed by the fact that never once, Not one place in this article has the term anti-Semitism or anti-Semites crept in here. There are many, many people, certainly many, many Jews, both in Israel and America, who make no distinction between being anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. They would say, if you don't like Israel, if you have problems with the state of Israel, the way it does things, you automatically hate Jews. They make that leap into the other category automatically and without hesitation. That's the only good thing I could say about this article, is at least they don't use anti-Semitism or Semites or anti-Semitic phrases like that. I mean, they don't use those phrases. Then again, what I meant by envious is or being impressed is, I think they're getting smart. I think this people at the times of Israel are beginning to realize that it can be detrimental to their cause, detrimental to the cause of Zionism, to make that leap. Okay. Anti-Israel activists in the United States create local autonomous groups that communicate and cooperate with a variety of like-minded organizations. They're giving a description here to how BDS operates, first by characterizing it as a bunch of little autonomous groups that communicate on a loose basis with other groups of the same mind, of this, of more or less the same purpose. Almost as though there is something foreboding about that. They might get stronger and become more unified. And then right away, the very next sentence in this particular paragraph is, but the Jewish community has a network no less impressive, which is true. Jewish Federations of North America consists of 157 local federations, and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs boasts 125 local community relations councils. Add to those figures, as it says here, Campus Hillels. That's the B'nai B'rith representation of Judaism on college campuses. The religious organizations from the four major streams of Judaism and the potential of a network starts to become clear. So they themselves, as it were, defenders of Israel and Israel's legitimacy, is using their view of the opposition as a way to strengthen themselves. Fighting fire with fire, they would tell you. But it's interesting to me because they admit the very extensive influence of Jewish organizations in North America, in the United States, and Canada. They have been around for a very long time. There are dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of such Jewish organizations or pro-Israel organizations in the U.S. And in past situations, they have already acted in unison on some issues. They have been known to jump together en masse to, for example, to oppose the nomination of Chuck Hagel, who used to be a U.S. senator and is now the Secretary of Defense, chosen and appointed by President Obama, really because Hagel dared to make reference to the fact that there is an Israeli lobby in the United States. As soon as various Jewish organizations and federations caught wind of this, they jumped on the bandwagon and ganged up in the media with one voice, as they say, against the nomination of Mr. Hagel for what they would consider to be anti-Israel propaganda, namely the fact that Hagel admitted that Israel, the nation of Israel, has influence in Washington, D.C. by virtue of its lobby or lobbies there. So this has happened before. It's hardly a new idea. And now the Jewish Federation, etc., want to do it even more, to fight BDS. What is boycott, divestment, and sanctions to begin with? Clearly, it's an economic thing. It's using economics to attack and to bring attention to the behavior of what really is a rogue state, considered to be a rogue state in the world community, namely Israel, in that it won't listen to world opinion, constantly thumbs its nose at the United Nations resolutions and censures of its own against Israel. It's not a new thing for Israelis to do. Up until recently, everything else having failed in order to establish justice in Israel and Palestine, in order to liberate the Palestinian people, in order to establish two states, in order to have any successful peace process. All that having failed up to this point, BDS has been approached in a kind of desperate bid to force the hand of Israel when it is being affected economically. People do this all the time in the real world. You know, it's you try to do things in a civil manner. Sometimes you take some more aggressive measures. Emotions flare, words fly. And in the end, it's money that counts. Is that a terrible sin? Seems to be the modus operandi of so much activity in the human race. BDS has long ago decided that they have no choice but to use the economic sanctions strategy in dealing with Israel. If they're not going to play ball with common decency and make some real sincere efforts towards peace, a just and lasting true peace in the Holy Land, in the Middle East, then we're going to deny you commerce. That's the purpose of BDS. It is specifically related to the military occupation of territories which Israel occupied with their army in 1967 with a surprise attack on Egypt and a very well planned, masterfully anticipated defeat of Jordanian forces, which held on to what remained of historic Palestine and pushed Jordan out of the picture, and which succeeded in attacking and holding on to land only a few scant miles from the gates of Damascus, which is the capital of Syria. Israel holds on to both of those areas today and continues to govern them with a military government and a military governor. At least that's the case for the West Bank. I'm not sure how they administer the Golan Heights in Syria, land that belongs to Syria. Okay. Why did I start talking about that? Land that's occupied by force of arms, situation has not changed. Except for a few very monumental changes, like, and this is one example, the move to nonviolent resistance and garnering public support through nonviolent measures, including civil disobedience in various forms, among Palestinians, among those who are occupied and oppressed. That is one of the most significant developments in the past two or three decades, in the West Bank in particular, and Palestinian, Israeli Palestinians, as some would call themselves, inside Israel itself are becoming more politically savvy and starting to stand up for the rights, property rights, and political rights within Israel amongst their Jewish brethren. They haven't been getting a fair shake. BDS is orientated, it is oriented towards the inequities, including the occupations, West Bank, Golan Heights, the effective occupation, ongoing occupation of the Gaza Strip. I have never heard anything within any BDS campaign, and I have attended a number of meetings and talks having directly to do with boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Never heard anything that even addresses the attempt to delegitimize the nation of Israel as a nation. We each may have our personal opinions about that, and including the history of modern Israel, how it came to being, but we all know to keep those under wraps during BDS meetings and discussions because they're really not appropriate. Again, I have never heard anyone make a peep about delegitimizing Israel. The phrase of delegitimize Israel has only come, by my readings, from supporters of Israel who insist upon calling it that, even if they know full well that the purpose of BDS is in response to Israel's occupation of land that does not belong to them. In response to the very poor treatment of Palestinians in those aforementioned three major areas, and within Israel, in particular Jerusalem, and in particular their East Jerusalem. Thousands and expectedly tens of thousands of Palestinian Arabs, non-Jewish Israelis to one degree or another, depending on the status of your citizenship, have been or are going to be ethnically cleansed, in particular from East Jerusalem, which the PLO and the Palestinian Authority has justifiably attempted to maintain as the capital of a new free and independent and secure Palestinian state. This alone explains why Israel is ethnically cleansing the Palestinians from East Jerusalem and replacing them with as many Jews and as quickly as they can. Total sabotage of the effort, which flies in the face of pretty much the rest of the attempt to create a state of Palestine, internationally recognized and truly sovereign state of Palestine. Israel knows that they want East Jerusalem, and they're not letting them have it. Incidentally, tune into this show on Saturday, 11 a.m., Mideast Madness Weekend Edition. I almost sound like I'm on NPR here when I use that phrase. I don't care. The Weekend Edition of Mideast Madness, Saturday, 11 a.m., and I will reread the entire article. I only got through the first half, but I'll reread the article, A Short History of Jerusalem, by Yonatan Mendel. And we will discuss again, and you will learn from me, my children, what's really going on in Jerusalem, and how it is really is an attempt at sabotaging justice for the Palestinians who live there and in the rest of Palestine. Getting back to BDS, it's kind of sickening how this report uses phrases or quotes people who uses phrases that are kind of innocuous. And they're talking, they use words in the article like proactive and partnerships in describing how they're gonna how the various Jewish community groups are gonna get together and cooperate more in defeating BDS, when all they're really doing is the whole thing, as I see it, is an attempt to pull attention away from the real orientation of BDS, namely the occupations and justice for native Palestinian Arabs, and relabel it as delegitimizing Israel, anti-Israel activity. They use that phrase over and over again. That anti-Israel has a somewhat nebulous, somewhat neutral quality to it. It doesn't exactly go so far as to say anti-Semitic, but it won't say anti-Zionist either. They don't use the word Zion or Zionism or Zionist in this article either, just as they don't use anti-Semite or anti-Semitism. So they're trying to replace the true intentions of the BDS, the noble intentions of the BDS movement, since nothing else has worked in the past 65 years, towards what's supposed to be happening over there in that part of the world. The article cites BDS resolutions which call for divestment from corporations operating in Israel. This is an economic attack, clearly. Holding in an attempt to hold Israel's feet to the fire and make them act like good citizens and a decent government. Corporations operating in Israel, including Motorola. What does Motorola do? They make parts for bombs and parts for, I believe, timing devices for various bombs that the Israeli Army and Israeli Air Force have used against basically defenseless people. You know, here you have a very powerful, sixth largest military establishment in the world, in the entire planet, and you have that technology and that power against people who really don't have an army as such as their own. The closest they can get to acting anywhere remotely like a military force is firing missiles and mortars from the Gaza Strip. Oh, so terrible of them when they have been under occupation for 45 years. Coming up on 46. So, what does Motorola do? They're instrumental in manufacturing instruments for bombs and targeting systems and delivery systems. And some of these bombs, some of actually a lot of the weaponry utilized by the Israeli military against civilian populations is considered illegitimate according to world opinion. There are certain bombs like cluster bombs and white phosphorus, which is not supposed to be used in an offensive capacity. Of course, anything that Israel does in terms of fighting largely defenseless Palestinian citizens is considered by Israel to be defensive. So there's a massive blurring of the lines there. That's Motorola. Caterpillar, you know, the big bulldoze machine people and the crane and the claw makers. We in the U.S. are used to associating those names with progress and construction, and in some cases, tearing down ramshackle buildings and urban renewal. That's what it means, but it traditionally has meant in the United States, and that's the image they put forward for a very long time. Caterpillar provides the bulldozers and monster machines which have been used to demolish Palestinian houses. Rarely with any real justification, and often illegally, even according to Israeli law that's on the books. Caterpillar bulldozers every day knock down another Palestinian domicile, and really it has nothing to do with defense. It has to do with Israeli expansionism of their settlements into the rest of Palestine and to rid the land of Arabs. That is the stated objective of Zionism. It is the historical stated objective of Zionism. Rid the land of Arabs, replace them with our own Jewish people. That's Caterpillar. Hewlett-Packard, HP, as it's referred to these days here, so often in the United States, software, including software for weapons delivery systems and other military support. That's who they are, and that's what they do. And as for the rest of my comments, it's just an overall cynicism of how they verse their activities to fight BDS in somewhat casually defensive terms, and how they're going to work with labor unions, and as though they're taking a communication approach. But this just continues to take attention off of the real purpose of BDS. Not to destroy Israel. Those who support Israel are always going to charge the rest of the world with trying to destroy Israel. Why do they do that? Because it's worked so successfully for 65 years. Call everybody else a genocidal maniac. Call everyone else a Jew hater. Never mind the sins that the Zionists themselves commit every day with impunity and without resonating criticism. It's still very hard to make reasonable and legitimate criticisms against the state of Israel. Okay. Folks, it's 4:52. It is... God, I wish they wouldn't do that. Back to the folder. I want to remind everyone of the... Back to my drafts folder here. Refusing to be enemies. The author of the new book, Refusing to Be Enemies, Palestinian and Israeli Nonviolent Resistance to the Israeli Occupation, Maxine Kaufman-LaCosta, will be speaking at the San Jose Peace and Justice Center, 48 South 7th Street in San Jose. Just Google San Jose Peace and Justice Center. It'll give you the details, including the bus routes, et cetera, et cetera. The talk begins at 7 p.m. It's this Friday. Here it is. 7 p.m. this Friday, July 12th in San Jose. Suggested a donation of 5 to 10, though no one will be refused for lack of funds. The important thing is getting the word out. So take advantage, whether you have cash in your pockets or not, of this educational opportunity, this attempt to reach out to the world. Maxine Kaufman LaCosta lived in Jerusalem for 7 years and has written widely on Palestinian and Israeli nonviolent activism, including a great number, if not for the most part, of joint Palestinian and Israeli projects of nonviolent activism. JewishVoiceForPeace.org. Write to South Bay at JewishVoiceForPeace.org. I want to remind everyone again that I feel like I'm in the middle of a kind of race before the bad guys come in here and shut me down and shut this radio service down, which they've done in the past, long before I was ever involved with it, and long before they end my attempt to establish reasonable dialogue about what's going on out there. I need people to get with it and to listen to the show and to call me and to tell their friends. A race between the threatened demise of Mideast Madness, the show, and its popularity reaching a critical mass where it's that much harder for them to do it. Send your messages to Mideast Madness at gmx.com. I'll talk to you again on Saturday at 11 a.m. for the weekend version of Mideast Madness. This is Ren on Free Radio Santa Cruz, currently streaming at freakradio.org. I am EMC. Palestine Today is next. Till next time, so long, everyone.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for June 29th to July 5th, 2013. The Palestinian new Prime Minister focused this week on the deteriorating economy, and the Israeli army attacks leave one Palestinian killed and five others injured this week. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report as usual with the nonviolent activities organized in the West Bank. This week, protests were organized in the villages of Al-Nabi Saleh, Bil'in, and Ni'lin in central West Bank, in addition to Al-Ma'sara in the southern West Bank. IMEMC's Salam Kumsiya reports.
At the villages of Bil'in and Ni'lin, residents and their international and Israeli supporters managed to reach the wall. Soldiers stationed there fired tear gas and chemical water on protesters. Many civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation.